how the coronavirus pandemic has changed how we feel about a lot of things, being inside, being outside, being around people, around friends and family. And that's related to how the coronavirus has changed what we think of as safe. But our next guest says our perceptions of safety and risk don't always match up with reality, and they may be shaped in part by who we listen to. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How is what you think about as being safe or not safe changed since March? And have you found your version of a risk? What you're willing to do? What kind of gatherings you're willing to have be different than your friends, family, neighbors, coworkers, bosses? Is it a point of conflict with people who view things differently than you two when it comes to risk and COVID-19? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She covers health. In a recent piece, she looked into the differences between how people perceive what's safe and what's actually safe and how the coronavirus pandemic has changed things. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Amanda, you've written a really interesting piece. What sets you down this path of these subtle questions about how we think about risk?
Well, really, I got interested in this sort of slowly over time as I began to watch how people reacted to the news that masks were helpful for containing the risk of coronavirus as we got more specific recommendations on what kind of gatherings we could or could not have. When we learned about ventilation and all of this information started coming through in a way that was like with a fairly good amount of certainty behind it. And then I watched people either try to adapt to those things or reject them entirely without really sound reasoning or evidence behind it. So I got interested in why people reject new safety measures and why people resist evidence. And then I sort of started to notice another layer of this story where it's people who agree with you on most things, people whose decision making often lines up with yours in everyday life, your friends, your family. Most of those groups are sort of politically homogenous for most people to a certain extent. And I saw people with similar values and similar beliefs about the pandemic just choosing entirely different ways to behave during it and all, you know, acting in good faith, thinking that they were doing the right things. So I felt like those two reactions were probably tied in some way psychologically. So I started calling around to ask experts what they thought was going on.
And one interesting thing here, before we dig into what you talk about, sort of a tribal response, this is a weird kind of thing to fear, right? There are some visceral things like, oh, there's a wild animal about to attack me, or thinking about the risk of a violent crime, or even a really visibly effective disease like Ebola, something that we can picture and feel that sense of visceral horror. This is more conceptual in a lot of ways. Does that complicate our ability to assess it and to assess the risk?
Absolutely. This particular type of threat provides like a couple of complications when it comes to evaluating the risk correctly and responding accordingly. The ways that people learn what they should be afraid of come through personal experience. So your own interactions with, say you're hiking and you come upon a bear and the bear chases you. You know you should be afraid of bears. Or a friend goes hiking and they take a video while they're hiking of a bear chasing them and show it to you when they get home. You understand, although you did not encounter the bear yourself, you understand from your friend who you trust in the video, which you can see with your own eyes, that bears aren't to be messed with. And then there's this third category of learning from authority figures who you trust and who you expect will tell you about things and give you information that you can't have yourself because of the different levels of authority you have in the society you live in. So that would be a leader in your community telling you that we've seen some bears around recently. We've heard some reports. Everybody keep your pets inside. There's a threat around, even though we don't have any proof. And so those are the three ways that we learn about everything, really. from bears to diseases. And like you said, because this is a disease where people, when they die from it, they die at home alone or in hospitals alone. It's a threat that came from far away at first. So the distance between your community and in your social circle and your in-group and the source of that threat or the perceived source of that threat, the further it is, the harder it is to get people to conceptualize their threat level accurately. So because of the type of disease this is, and because it came from literally the other side of the world, we are already on sort of our back foot when it comes to responding accurately and responding quickly.
Talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic, she wrote a piece about our perception of risk, the COVID-19 pandemic, how it's affected our response. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Particularly curious if you've had experiences where in your workplace, with your family, your friends, you and the other people had different perceptions about risk. Is it okay to do this? Is it okay to have this gathering? Do we need the masks? Do we need to be outside? How have you resolved that? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Amanda, let's get into the sort of the tribalized response you point to. Ideally, I hear from a lot of public health people, you get one consistent message repeated over and over again by leaders, authority figures, experts, and that sort of thing. That's not what's happened here. What have you seen happening instead?
The reaction to the pandemic has been scattered and confused and disorienting and misinformed in a way that makes it a lot harder even for well-informed, vigilant, caring people to make good decisions. The consistency over time of messaging from authority figures is really, really important when you have a situation in which the threat is coming from far away and it's not affecting people in front of your face. And so we have had at various levels of government, we have had people spreading misinformation, people likening the effects of the virus and its danger to the flu. We have had people telling you not to wear masks, not to avoid eating inside of restaurants. When, on the other hand, public health officials, the people who study these things and who spend their, you know, it's their life's work to respond to these threats, are telling you masks work, don't eat indoors at restaurants, don't go to parties, you know. They're telling you the exact opposite of the known authority figures that you listen to in everyday life. And that creates this sort of miasma of information where people are trying to parse all of these new facts, and the average person just doesn't have the ability to do it. They don't have the scientific background. They don't have the time. People, you know, everybody is so stressed out. Everybody is attending to kids, and people are keeping their kids home from school and trying to keep their jobs or trying to find new jobs. There's just not a lot of extra energy and extra mental space to figure out who's lying to you and who's not.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Ben joins us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. You know, over the last couple of days during the election, pundits have been talking about the voter response, and they talked about a division between people who were more concerned about the economy tending to vote Republican and people who were concerned about the coronavirus were voting for Democrats. And it occurs to me that it's possible, because like your guest, I couldn't figure out why people were ignoring these clear danger signs. But it occurs to me that there may have been a cynical disinformation campaign from the very beginning on the part of the president to try to get people to support him in the election by ignoring the dangers of the virus. Thank you.
Ben, thanks for the call. Amanda, I mean, people have been weighing the, you know, how much do you let the economy keep going versus trying to stop the flow of the coronavirus. What are your thoughts on what Ben had to say?
I think that he's on to something on two different levels. I think that there was like a purposeful effort on the part of the federal government, on the part of Trump and his officials, to decouple the control of the virus from the progress of the economy. In reality, you can't decouple those things. The way that people go back to shopping, go back to dining, go back to spending the money that they would normally spend is you get the virus under control, you save people's jobs, you save people's lives, you make them feel confident in going in their safety and going back out into relatively normal life again. But what the federal government did was separate those two things instead of making the more nuanced argument about controlling the virus. And when you separate those two things, you have a lot of people who are very much bought into the group identity of being a Trump supporter. You know, you see the crowds at rallies, you see all the merch sales. People have really committed themselves and parts of their identities to this. So if the people whose authority they've committed themselves to says the economy has nothing to do with the virus, we need to focus on the economy, I'm focusing on the economy, this is the only way we're going to save it, even if people given better information might be inclined to make the connection between controlling the virus and saving the economy, they've already built a lot of their self-perception on believing this person who is telling them that he knows the way out. And group identity provides safety too. It provides community, it provides support, it provides a sense of self. So a lot of times people, especially in stressful situations, fall back on that. So you get this ultimately, I think, successful effort to decouple the control of the pandemic from the progress of the economy.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to health writer Amanda Mull from The Atlantic about what the coronavirus has done to how people think about what's safe and what's not in this country and how to weigh risks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your life much, a lot, not at all, as you look at the risk of coronavirus? Why do you think we've divided into two political camps on the issue of a disease? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Amanda Mull from The Atlantic, talking about COVID-19 and our perceptions of what's safe and what's not. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Let's bring on another caller now. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hi.
Hi, I just had two quick points. I myself have zero fear of it. I'm trying to live normally, but I'm a stagehand, so I've been totally out of work since March. Now, these are the two very important facts that I come to this conclusion. March 8th, Dr. Fauci, who is the superior person on this, March 8th, he said, the masks do nothing. Now, is he lying on March 8th? Is he lying now? And number two.
Yes. Okay, I think we lost Ray there. Ray, thanks for calling in. So that the mask thing, the thought early on was masks didn't work. The science came in, Amanda, and said, oh, wait, yes, they do actually work. That's the progression of events, right?
Yeah, I think that when you look at failures of the pandemic response, there was a lot of confusion early and not a lot of facts early. March 8th was extremely early in studying the virus. And I think that we didn't know the extent to which the virus was spreading through the air versus spreading through droplets that had settled on surfaces and then were picked up by people's hands and touching the face. We over time after that, it became clear that the vast majority of the spread was happening through the air. So once that became clear, they started changing their recommendations on masks. And I think that there was also a admittedly bungled messaging on their hand at first that masks were only useful for people who might be infected themselves. And I think that they overestimated that point because they were afraid that there was going to be a run on masks and then they wouldn't be able to get any for healthcare workers. And I think it is still true that masks are primarily most helpful for ensuring that people who are infected and don't realize it don't spread the virus to other people. But I think that more science has come in now, and we know that there is also a protective element to wearing them if you're not infected, and how much that will help prevent you from breathing in droplets that are emitted by other people. So I think that it is a combination of how much we've learned over such a short period of time, and admittedly just bad messaging from some public health officials at the beginning, when they should have been more transparent on what they were thinking about and why they were making that recommendation.
Ray, thanks for calling in. Sorry if the drop there was from our end. But I want to talk about Ray's other point. He is one of many people in one of those lines of work that has been hit really hard. Bartenders, restaurant workers, people who work at events like he does. They are personally affected economically. There is harm to them. We had some help for them with the CARES Act. Have we done enough for those people who are really taking the brunt of shutdowns, Amanda?
Absolutely not. We have failed them at every level of government, starting from the federal government. The best way to help people in this situation, and there's a lot of them where I live too. I have a lot of friends who are out of work with little prospect of returning soon. But the best way to do this is to do a coordinated federal effort. The federal government has access to resources that state governments and local governments just don't. They can print money. So if we had had a concerted federal effort to make sure that people got the money that they need in order to pay their rent, pay their bills, feed their kids, feed themselves, keep the heat on early and consistently, I think that so many people would be in such a better situation now. But we're in a widespread enough crisis that nobody can personal responsibility their way out of this. Nobody can choose their way out of this. You have to work together as a community, as a country. And that is that's the way that other countries have had success with this, with keeping people in their homes, with keeping people fed, while we try to keep everybody physically healthy too.
Thanks for that call, Ray. We're talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic about a piece she wrote on our divided views on COVID-19, our perception of risk on a kind of a hard to grasp a spreading illness where our response has gone wrong. Amanda, given that this divide on COVID-19 has fallen along either side of this deep political divide, when you talk to experts, as you look at things yourself, do you see ways to bridge that and get consistent messaging to people as this thing, numbers-wise, keeps getting worse?
Yes, and there's a couple of things that are going to influence this, I think. I think that as the virus spreads further, more and more people are going to know someone who has been personally affected by this, and that tends to change personal behavior. It's not going to change everybody's behavior. It's not going to move the needle for all of us, but being the closer in proximity you are to something that threatens your safety, the more likely you are to take it seriously. So as the pandemic spreads, I think you will see shifting behaviors that are likely to keep everybody safer. And then I also think that what I keep hearing experts say is that if we can get through this winter, things are going to improve. Gradually throughout next year, we're going to get better, better medicines, the vaccines are coming. So if we can just be empathetic with each other and not dismiss each other, not assume the worst of each other, and just work with each other on a human level, the people in our families, the people in our social circles, in our communities, and just have like a little bit more empathy for each other, I think that that goes a long way. When you're trying to message behavior change to people, the best thing you can do is just communicate open and honestly and non-judgmentally. And you can disarm a lot of angry people that way. You can't do it to everybody, but people in proximity to you, people who are known to you, I think that just hearing them out and trying to be empathetic has its uses in that.
Time for one more caller. Harlow is with us, calling from near Duluth. Harlow, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up? Yep, you're on the air. What do you want to bring up, Harlow?
Well, recently I had a termite inspection at my house in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and the person doing the work, a young, intelligent, college-educated person, just kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, oh, this coronavirus business is just so confusing. And to me, I don't think it's confusing at all. And so I was wondering why he felt confused. And I decided that it was two things, which you have, your guests have touched upon, and your Atlantic author has touched upon. I think one is that we don't understand science. The man on the street doesn't understand science. The answers change as we get more information. And in the case of the coronavirus, we knew nothing back last February, really nothing at all. And we know a lot more now. And so obviously that we apply this greater knowledge.
And so, Harlow, I'm going to have to cut you off after one point. I'm sorry. We just have a minute or so left. Amanda, the importance, this is a good place to end it. I think the importance of communicating changes in our scientific understanding as this thing goes on.
Right. Absolutely. This is one of the most crucial points, because I think that Americans, especially over the past 4 years, have gotten used to deciding that everything is politics, that everything, you pick a decision, you pick a point, you pick something to believe, and you defend it till the death. And if you change your opinion, you have lost. That is just the absolute opposite of what science is. In science, we evolve our understanding of things over time as more information is known. Changing your position on something is positive, because it means we know more. It means we've added to the knowledge base. It means we're doing a better job than we were weeks or months ago. So I think that people should try to open themselves to that change, because it's going to make your life easier. It's going to make your life safer. And it's going to be what gets us through this.
Thanks for that call, Harlow. And Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Amanda Mull at The Atlantic. She covers health there, and we talked to her today about some of her work covering what makes people fearful for their safety, how that's changed with the pandemic, and why we have radically different perceptions of the risk of the disease and what we need to do about it.